Pittsburgh to Selins Grove, Uniontown to Lebanon, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Tom Wolf wants to raise Pennsylvania's minimum wage, but doing so will reduce entry-level job opportunities. Mark Hendrickson from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College is here to explain. It is a program that helps inmates prepare to re-enter society, and it saves dogs in need of special training. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Rob Rosa of New Leash on Life in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And the nuclear power industry is unable to compete in the energy marketplace, so it is seeking a government bailout. Beth Ann Mumford of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Mark Hendrickson in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania Supreme Court is once again in the spotlight, and as with past appearances at center stage, the reason is not good. Justice Kevin Dougherty, brother of indicted Philadelphia labor leader and political power broker Johnny Doc Dougherty, has been implicated as the beneficiary of some of his brother's misdeeds. While the justice has not been indicted, the association with his brother that paved the way for his elevation to the high court now threatens his judicial career. Dougherty was one of the Democrat justices who last year ordered a controversial re-gerrymander of the state's congressional districts and implemented a highly partisan plan that resulted in the election of more Democrats to the state's congressional delegation. In recent years, a number of justices on the high court have been forced to resign for, among other things, viewing and sending sexually inappropriate emails, and in one case, using taxpayer-funded staff to do political work. John Dougherty, along with Philadelphia City Councilman Bobby Hennen, were indicted on a variety of public corruption charges. Johnny Doc also was a prime mover behind the election of Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, who faces a re-election fight this year. Two state senators have introduced legislation that would create what they termed common-sense work requirements for able-bodied Medicaid recipients. The proposal by state senators David Argel and Scott Martin would require those who are able-bodied, able-minded, and who do not have minor dependents to attend job training programs, seek employment, or to volunteer in their community in order to continue receiving benefits. The measure is meant primarily to move such individuals into family-sustaining jobs, thus preserving financial resources for those truly in need. And the Cato Institute has released its annual Fiscal Policy Report Card on America's Governors, and Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf was one of eight governors to receive an F. Wolf's failing grade was due to policy actions, which the report said, quote, undermines the environment for business growth in Pennsylvania, and it lists the governor's persistent efforts to raise taxes as a major factor in his poor performance assessment. Read about all things Pennsylvania at the all-new patownhall.com. Governor Tom Wolf wants to raise Pennsylvania's minimum wage ultimately to $15 per hour. Such government tampering with the marketplace would result in fewer job opportunities and less hours for those working at entry-level jobs. To explain why, we turn to Mark Hendrickson, who is an adjunct professor of economics and a fellow at the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Mark, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Mark, Governor Tom Wolf is proposing, like many so-called progressives across the country, a significant increase in Pennsylvania's minimum wage. Can you tell us exactly what it is the governor is proposing?
Currently, Pennsylvania's minimum wage is the same as the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour. The governor has proposed to raise it all the way from $7.25 to $12 per hour, effective this July 1st, and then have built-in increases of 50 cents a year every year until 2025, which would take it up to $15 an hour.
As the governor is proposing this, and we've seen this happen in some other states, what was it just a week or so ago? Didn't New Jersey go all the way to $15 per hour in one jump?
Well, no, New York City did, and you're right about other states having done it. There are already 28 states in the District of Columbia that have raised the minimum wage above the federal rate. The thing is, what's happening, at least the example that I'm familiar with from the last couple of months, just January, really, on January 1st in New York City, the minimum wage went up to $15 an hour. And their hospitality organization did a survey of restaurants and others, and they found that 75% of restaurants are going to be reducing employee hours, the number of hours that the employees work now that they cost more to hire. And 53%, more than half, say they're actually going to have to eliminate some jobs. So you got a lot of people getting hurt by this measure. And that's what always happens with the minimum wage. You raise the price above the market price, demand goes down. So you have people all of a sudden who were working, and now they're earning less because they're working fewer hours, or they're earning zero because they lose their jobs.
Let's talk a little bit about who actually earns the minimum wage and what their circumstances are. Of course, Governor Wolf and those who are proposing dramatic increases in the wage try to throw out words like, well, it's fair, it's equitable, people have to have a, quote, living wage. But, Mark, is the minimum wage meant to be a living wage?
Yeah, well, there was never meant to be a minimum wage at all. There's a market for wages, like there's a market for eggs, apples, cereal, whatever. So that's a little bit of a false premise right from the beginning. But the notion that somebody should be able to work a minimum wage job and raise a family on that is ridiculous. I mean, the minimum wage jobs, the low-paying jobs, are what? They're the low-skilled jobs. And there's a lot of people that can fill those. And so a lot of these jobs are filled by high school kids and college kids working on the side. Some are filled by, you know, seniors or just people who've raised kids and want to get out of the house for a few hours a day and stuff. 94% of adults earning the minimum wage live with another adult who also earns an income. In other words, it's not only in rare cases is it the only income of a family. It can be the only income of a young single person just out of college. I worked a minimum wage job after I was a college graduate, one of the best jobs I ever had, but I couldn't live on it. I mean, I worked a second job at night taking care of a quadriplegic, which gave me free room and board. That enabled me to afford to work this job for a while. But the market was basically saying, Mark, what you got to do here is you've got to go into a job that pays more, that contributes more value to society, because that's when an employer will pay you more, when the value of your labor is higher. It's just a temporary thing. It's to give especially young people and inexperienced workers a toehold to get into the job market and then just go on from there. It's not meant to be a lifelong income.
We are talking with Mark Hendrickson, who is an adjunct professor of economics and fellow at the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College, talking about Governor Tom Wolf's proposal to raise the state's minimum wage. And Mark, you've pointed out what the practical impact of these increases are, which is fewer hours, fewer jobs for the lower end of the scale. And the reason why we have minimum wage jobs, or why we have entry-level jobs might be a better term for it. But talk a little bit about the economics here. The governor and those who like to proscribe government solutions to problems are essentially saying, this is the wage and you therefore have to pay it and find a way to do so. But if you're really looking at how the economy works, is not the pay scale for a job based upon the value that that particular labor brings to a product or service? Do they not have this precisely backward?
Yeah, they're trying to say what something should be worth. They're interfering in one of our basic freedoms, which is the freedom to enter into a contract. There are a lot of employers who would hire workers and a lot of workers who would accept the employer's offer at a lower wage than minimum wage if it were legal. What has happened is every time historically the minimum wage has gone up, is that by raising the price of labor, they've reduced the demand for labor, and you end up with unemployment as a side effect, rising unemployment as a side effect of the minimum wage. So economically, it's counterproductive. And the funny thing is, a lot of these progressives who are in favor of the minimum wage, they will acknowledge in some cases, the more honest ones. I'm thinking of governor or former governor of California, Jerry Brown. I've got a quote from him from just 3 years ago. He says, economically, minimum wages may not make sense. but morally and socially and politically, they do. Well, the only place they make sense is politically, because politicians like to play Santa Claus. They might like to portray themselves as the champions of the poor who are going to help these downtrodden people and so on and so forth. Well, they're not helping them when they put them out of work. And there's a lot of moral pretense. I mean, they get votes for doing it. Even some business people, Loewen, favor raising the minimum wage. But I bet you any business person who says that is already paying his own employees more than the minimum wage. And because businesses, the businessmen sometimes like to play tricks against their competition, they want their competition to have to pay higher wages also so that they become less competitive. That's why unions always support higher minimum wage, even though no union member works at the minimum wage. They're just trying to raise the floor because then their own wages go up proportionally or have a chance to go up proportionally. And you find that there's just a bunch of naked self-interest there. So politically, you know, Governor Wolf might have enough support to push this through, but economically, it's going to hurt some innocent poor people.
Is this also not a symptom, Mark, of the superioristic attitude that many in government have, that they, more so than the private sector, can determine what it is ought to be paid and manage the economy? Is it really possible for a set of lawmakers or a bureaucracy to gather the information necessary to micromanage an economy efficiently? I don't believe that's ever actually been done anywhere.
Well, they've attempted it. It's called socialism, where the government essentially runs the business operations of a country, and it dictates what gets produced and who gets paid what and so on and so forth, and you end up with an impoverished mess. So you're right. We need free markets that communicate to both buyers and sellers what individual actors in the marketplace value and how much they value it.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that when in New York City the minimum wage was introduced, that the reaction was to cut the number of jobs, to cut the number of hours. But Mark, what impact does raising the minimum wage have on, for example, those folks who currently make between $10 and $15 an hour? They are above minimum wage. If you raise the minimum wage, aren't the people the next step up going to say, now that person below me is making as much, if not more than me, so I should make more. And then the person above them will say, well, I should make more. Doesn't this sort of create an inflationary effect?
Well, yes. That's assuming, of course, that the employers can afford to give everybody raises. And that's a dubious prospect. One of the reasons that jobs go down after an increase in the minimum wage is that some of these people who lay off workers, some of these business people, these small business people in particular, they can't make enough of a profit to even keep their business going. So they don't lay off just some of their workers. They lay off all of their workers because they essentially have to shut down the business. So, yes, everybody will want more. There will be disgruntlement. People will say, well, yeah, if this low-skilled guy's getting this person and you're only paying me $2 an hour more, then what's right with that? But it just assumes this naive notion that you just wave a magic wand and all of a sudden these employers are just going to give everybody a raise. And you have to ask yourself, well, where are they going to get the money from? Well, they'll have to charge higher prices to consumers. The only thing is, you start charging higher prices to consumers, you get fewer consumers. Price goes up, demand goes down, and all of a sudden you're not making as much revenue, and therefore you can't pay higher wages or anything else. Let's remember the minimum wage workers, the latest statistics I got were from 2016, on a national basis, we're only talking about 3% of the workers anyhow. And as I say, most of those live in households with other incomes. So it's really kind of more of a symbolic issue. I mean, it hurts a small number of people. I mean, it can be significant on a nationwide basis. You take 3% of a workforce of 130 million people. Yeah, that's gonna cause problems and stuff. But why are we focusing on such a minor thing? I think it's more for the political and symbolic value, because economically it's just, as Governor Brown said, well, it doesn't make sense.
Mark Hendrickson is an adjunct professor of economics. He's also a fellow at the Center for Vision and Values, that at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. Mark, can you give us a website for the Center for Vision and Values where folks can go to read your work and also that of the many scholars who contribute?
Absolutely. Very simple to remember because it is Vision and Values. It's www.visionandvalues.org.
Mark Hendrickson from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Mark, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loewen. Good talking with you.
Inmates at Pennsylvania prisons are helping to train dogs with behavioral problems and the experience helps both human and animal. That is the mission of New Leash on Life. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Rob Rosa of New Leash on Life in this Community Benefit Spotlight.
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Rob, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
Thank you for having us.
So, Rob, you're involved with an organization at many levels called New Leash on Life. Can you tell us a little bit about the program and where the inspiration came to get it started?
So New Leash on Life USA is a 501c3 nonprofit reentry organization. And what we do is we rescue dogs that are at risk to be euthanized, and we place them in a prison. We pair them with people experiencing incarceration, and the goal is to train the dogs with basic obedience and to enhance their ability for adoption.
It seems like it's a growing trend that in all kinds of different rehabilitation or recovery programs to use animals. With the dogs, how do you select these dogs? You said that they may be up for euthanization. How do you select them? And then how do you pair them with the right prisoner to work?
We work with the city shelter here in Philadelphia, and we search for dogs that are either surrender because they have nuisance behavior issues or have been adopted and returned due to lack of training. The inspiration of the program was our founder, Mary Marchese, who was a volunteer at the city shelter, experienced a lot of time at the shelter where she saw really wonderful dogs that had great potential being adopted and returned and ultimately being euthanized. And she thought, what a great way to give these dogs a second chance by providing them a program where they can be trained and be transitioned into an adopted home without having to deal with those barriers.
From a dog's perspective, kind of an ideal setup because they would get to live with the prisoner, I understand, 24/7. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. The people experiencing incarceration actually giving up a section of their cell to house a crate where the dog will live there with them. And they're responsible for the care of the dog 24/7 days out of the week.
Anybody out there who has a dog knows what kind of companionship and unconditional love and trust and all the things that go along with that. It must be something very appealing to the inmate once the idea is shopped to them.
Yeah, the human-animal bond goes way back centuries, and we've been attached to dogs and dogs attached to humans for a very long time. They played many different roles. But as we evolved, the dogs evolved with us and they became our companions. Thus, providing us with all different levels of companionship, whether it's just being a loving pet or being a service pet. And for the participants, it's extremely important to be able to have a living thing or living being that is going to be non-judgmental towards whatever past they had that brought them to that situation.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio program. My guest today is Rob Rosa. Rob is speaking to us about a program called New Leash on Life, where rescued dogs get paired with people who are incarcerated and how it works out good for both parties. So how long does that relationship last, Rob? And then what happens to the dog at the end of that relationship?
Our pre-release program is a 12-week program. The first week, we are basically just preparing the people that we're working with to understand the expectations and what the needs are to take care of the animal. Once we select the dogs with our volunteers, and the dogs are transitioned into the prison, then it's 11 weeks of training, basic animal training. We use positive reinforcement method, and they also are getting basic animal care classes. Alongside of that, we provide them with life skills classes just some soft skills on anger management, decision making, and restorative justice, and career readiness classes.
And how is the person who's incarcerated get selected to be part of this program? It must be a little bit of a privilege to be involved with it.
There's an intensive selection process, and it's actually a partnership between the Philadelphia Department of Prison, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, the Philadelphia Defenders Association, and the Philadelphia Adult Probation and Parole. What they do is they interview the participants as long as they have good behavior while they're there at the prison. And then once they go through that first process, they're sent over to the District Attorney's Office to do a criminal background check just to make sure that they don't have anything in their background that would deem them eligible to do a program like this. Obviously, working with a dog, we wouldn't want anyone who had previous history of animal abuse, sexual abuse, or arson. And once that's approved, we begin the process of rebuilding and working towards change.
Just select a sample of what a day might look like between the prisoner and the dog. What would be a typical kind of day for them?
A typical day would be they wake up early in the morning, they're doing a potty break, and then they're providing the first meal to the dogs. They obviously have their breakfast, and by 9 o'clock they should be prepared for class. It'll be either life skills class or career readiness class or dog training or basic animal care class. We work with them typically from 9 to 12 in class. Depending on what class they're having, the dog might be in the crate and learning to stay in the crate while the participant is out working in the classes. During the rest of the day, they may have schedules where the dogs get exercise, or they are having individual training time, or the participants may be reading a book while the dogs are kind of just playing around in the cell. They also have to do their homework, where I think typically every class provides homework for them.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Rob Rosa. Rob, thank you for being a guest. Would you share with the listeners a phone number and website address if they want more information?
Absolutely. If they want any more information, and obviously we welcome any type of support, our website is www.newleashonlife-usa.org.
Rob, thank you for being a guest in the Lincoln Radio Program. Congratulations and good luck. Back to you, Loman.
Cheaper costs for natural gas have made it difficult for the nuclear power industry to compete. So now it's asking for a taxpayer bailout. Beth Ann Mumford of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, offers her take on the request on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Remember Congress's bailout of Wall Street's big banks, the one where the connected few got special favors and regular consumers paid the price and then got angry? The Pennsylvania General Assembly is on the verge of another bailout, this time for the nuclear industry. Just as you footed the bill for Wall Street, soon you may be footing the bill for nuclear energy companies. Lobbyists for several large, profitable corporations that own nuclear power plants in Pennsylvania are asking lawmakers for your tax dollars. And the legislature seems interested in not just listening, but saying yes to handing over your money. These companies that have already received hundreds of millions of dollars from taxpayers in New Jersey, New York, and Illinois want a bailout and think you should chip in your own dollars to cover their costs for the rest of your life and your children and their children, a forever bailout. Pennsylvania has one of the most competitive energy markets in the country, benefiting all consumers across the Commonwealth. And consumers have choices with options to select their energy provider from lowest cost to lowest carbon footprint. It's the right approach. Consumers get to choose from a menu of energy options that best reflect their family budget and their preferences for coal, natural gas, wind, solar, nuclear, and so on. This is a win for families like yours. And when Pennsylvania made the decision to deregulate our energy market decades ago, nuclear companies received taxpayer dollars then to help them make the transition. So why are lawmakers giving a hearing to an idea that will drive up utility bills for those least likely to afford them? From seniors to low-income households, increased utility bills create real problems for family budgets. 4 out of 5 of Pennsylvania's nuclear reactors are profitable, and one, Three Mile Island in Dauphin County, is scheduled to close. Yet instead of seeking ways to promote more competition, Harrisburg is looking for ways to give the favored few a few favors paid for by you. It's wrong to make Pennsylvanians subsidize special interest. No business model should be based upon a forever bailout. Our energy markets are open, deregulated, and that's how they should stay. All energy sectors should compete for your money, not force you to keep them afloat. Pennsylvanians shoulder the 15th highest tax burden in the nation and face a multi-billion dollar budget deficit due to Harrisburg's mismanagement. Call your lawmakers today and tell them it is not their job to pick winners and losers in the energy marketplace. Seniors and low-income families simply cannot afford a forever bailout. Lawmakers should reject efforts by special interests to help cover independent business decisions through bailouts, subsidies, or special policy carve-outs. Whether it's the nuclear industry or any industry, the free market should rule. For more than a year, America has been celebrating our newfound energy independence, which is driven by competition and innovation. Pennsylvania lawmakers should not get in the way of free market success. I'm Beth Ann Mumford, State Director of Americans for Prosperity. Join our effort at www.afppennsylvania.org.
You miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station. Audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WFRJ-FM in Windber, WROV-FM in Ridgeway, and WRYV-FM in State College, Pennsylvania. And the annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is coming up. The 30th anniversary Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 5th and 6th at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. This year's featured speaker will be Wall Street Journal columnist and commentator Kimberly Strassel. Jimmy Kemp of the Jack Kemp Foundation, Kay Coles James of Heritage Foundation, Mark Janis from the Liberty Justice Center, Selena Zito of the Washington Examiner, and Tim Gegline from Focus on the Family, as well as numerous others, will speak. There will be panel presentations on key state and national issues, workshops, and the opportunity to network with conservatives from across the state. To learn more and to register for the 2019 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, go to paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.